This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
BFM 89.9, you're listening to The Morning Run with Lynn Mark, Roshan Kennison and Noel Lim. It is 6 o'clock in the morning, Wednesday the 14th of April, the midpoint of yet another work week. How are we doing today, Noel?
I'm really happy because it's Wednesday.
Are you happy because it's one of two things for sure.
It's always the number of days to the weekend or
Thursday Junior. I'm beginning to sound like a broken record, right?
Okay, yeah. At this point, you know, you're going to come in on Monday and it's like Monday is going to be Friday Junior. Is that
Sunday Senior?
What about you, Roshan?
I'm feeling good. Yesterday was Vaisakhi, also the Hindu New Year's, either yesterday or today, either one of those. I know I should know better than that. And if I get...
We'll stand guided by you.
Yeah. So, but also it was a confluence of days yesterday, right? Because it was the first day of Ramadan. It was also Vaisakhi. Mm-hmm. It was a good feeling day overall. Also, I just want to shout out to the fact that we do every day. We got the breakfast grill today. And today I'll be speaking with Servier Malaysia's general manager. Now, they're the second largest pharmaceutical group in France, but they are not very big in Malaysia. In fact, you've probably never heard of Servier. So I'll be talking to them about their business in the country, as well as, I mean, expansion plans. What else do they do here? Do they have any manufacturing facilities, especially with all this FDI talk? It'll be interesting. I think based on my math, their global revenue, Malaysia represents 0.6% of that pie. That'll be an interesting conversation for sure.
And that's going to happen later on after the 8 o'clock news bulletin. Be sure to stay tuned for that. But a little closer to where we are right now, after the 6:30 news, Noel, what do we have on the agenda today?
We'll be looking at COVID-19 as usual, and there's been some news again about the vaccines, and this time it is Johnson & Johnson's vaccine, which is that single dose drug that we take. And also US troops, they will be or planning to leave Afghanistan by 11 September. It almost feels very, seems like a very memorable date. And also Minnesota, we are seeing some, fresh unrest, and also something about Hong Kong and Singapore.
Yeah, then towards the in about 10 minutes, though, we're going to take a look at minimum wage. And this is a story out of Australia, right? This is the conversation, is having a conversation about minimum wage and the resistance to it. And maybe the economic thinking around it is obsolete. Interesting. Definitely piqued my interest. Let's see what we can get into, what trouble we can get into in 10 minutes.
And if you want to join us in that trouble, we're on the conversations, you can WhatsApp us. The number is 018-789-789. 8899, or you can tweet us at BFM Radio. Up next, though, looking at the Swiss cheese model and how it explains the need for multiple layers of COVID-19 defense. Stay tuned, BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, that was Happy Music by the Blackbirds, and you're listening to The Morning Run with Lynn, Roshan and Noel. So the first story that we're taking a look at this morning is to do with the Swiss cheese model and how it's
used to fight COVID-19.
And I mean, it's not literally using a block of Swiss cheese to fight a pandemic.
What?
Because I can't imagine that would be particularly effective.
Fake news. Landmark, you are fake news. But of course you can use Swiss cheese to fight COVID-19. Just
sure.
Grate it on your food.
Grate it into your eye swam.
Just like rasam.
Well, sorry guys, when I read this article, all I could think of was cheeseburger. Everything around cheese except COVID.
Oh
makes
God.
You hungry, doesn't it? But this is an article from the BBC, and it's talking, the Swiss cheese here is a metaphor for any one of the measures that we use to try and prevent the pandemic from spreading. So vaccines would be one slice of Swiss cheese, you know, with holes and all. Mask wearing will be another slice. Washing your hands will be another slice. And the idea is that if you imagine multiple slices of Swiss cheese kind of like stacked together, yes, each one has holes in it, but at the end of the day, hopefully the holes kind of get cancelled out when you stack more layers on top of each other. In other words, we need many different layers of protection to prevent COVID-19 from spreading, not just one.
It's like it's diversification of risk, really, if you think about it in a way. And of course, trust me to take it into the investment money side of things. But essentially, so something like a vaccine with even 90% efficacy means you've got some holes there. It's smaller than you would expect, maybe differentiated from other things. But when you start stacking all these things together, The odds are that all these holes in these various layers of Swiss cheese are not going to line up perfectly for the for your defense to be breached. But the idea is essentially you're trying to mishmash as many together so that you get so that you feel like you're doing the best that you can to protect yourself and also kita jaga kita, kind of bring down the virus load as well, right? But at the same time, it's just diversification of that risk. And hopefully the sum of these different parts is not equivalent to the whole, but more than that, right? There's some synergy from all of this. But essentially, there's no 100% guarantee. All we can do as many things as we can to protect ourselves. Keep distant. It reduces the ability for the virus to transmit. If you wear a mask, you're reducing the ability for you to potentially spread it and also contract it. Because sometimes you don't know whether you've got the virus on you because of asymptomatic cases. The vaccinations are also part of that process.
Vaccination certainly does not provide 100% protection. You've read news of people contracting the virus even after just being vaccinated. And, you know, when we are reading now news about Chinese vaccines, they only offer like maybe 50% protection rate. So it really pays to be safe and to have this different approaches. So like that's why some governments call it the whole society approach, right? Mm. Where, you know, different actors in society need to play their role and we have to likewise, you know, do all our mitigating measures. But, you know, hovering in the background is all this thing about taking a risk-based approach, because while you're trying to stem out the pandemic, there's also like how do you open the economy? How do you balance with those needs? And more so than ever, we need this sliced cheese approach, right? I mean, just looking at the recent news where some schools in Malaysia, there are clusters now emerging. Mm-hmm. You know, of course, we say children are less likely to contract COVID or would suffer less severe consequences. But try telling that to your parents. You know, most parents would be, you know, ultra concerned about their own children, right? So, and who's going to take responsibility if something happens to your kid and worst case scenario, the kid succumbs to the virus?
Yeah, I think there are two sides to this, right? There are always going to be people who are less cautious. I'm just going to say that. And there are always going to be people who are more cautious or paranoid, like me, who are always going to feel a little bit of fear when you come back from a mall or something like that. Like, oh, did I do enough to protect myself or to keep away from the virus, quote unquote? But end of the day, we can only do as much as we can, right? So if I've gone to... Sorry about that. Something is trying to silence me in the studio. You know, when you think about it, when you go to a mall, we have to balance livelihoods with lives. Yes, we have to do all that. We want to stimulate the economy. As long as we're all doing our best to stay away from each other in the mall, keep distant, we are masking up, and we're keeping our hygiene intact, right? We're sanitizing and things like that. We are reducing the incidences. Nothing's ever going to be a guarantee. But what we're doing is, if everybody is reducing the incidences, the probabilities get even lower. It's math, right? Like, and I'm not going to go into probability math this early in the morning, but that's essentially what it is.
No, I was very happy to leave probability behind.
0.9 thank times you very much. 0.8 equals less.
Yes, you can end the conversation right now.
No, but I guess it's not just that we all need to be employing these SOPs. It's that we also need to check ourselves when we look ahead to the vaccine, as if it's going to be the silver bullet
exactly.
That's going to end all of these pandemic woes, right? Because the vaccines, from what we know, they're only a certain percentage effective. And we don't know yet whether there will be new variants. So things like maintaining social distancing, wearing masks, maintaining good hygiene, that's likely to stick around for a while. We can't let ourselves get complacent.
But also, there's going to be a fragmentation effect. Not everyone's going to get the vaccine at the same time. Herd immunity could take some time. Estimates are the US will be the first major economy to get herd immunity. But we're seeing delays in all of this, of the supply of COVAX, which means less developed nations are going to be behind the curve. Singapore is on its way to probably being the first country in Asia or Southeast Asia to hit herd immunity. Malaysia is estimated to be second on that list. But again, there's going to be fragmentation, which means things like the vaccine is not going to be the silver bullet. It's going to take a long time for us to reach any semblance of what was life before this. And actually, we had a conversation with Ryan Sweet of Moody's Analytics yesterday. The podcast is called Economic Implications on the Road to Herd Immunity. And he gave us a bit of context over what this could mean from a roadmap and an economic point of view from all these different things. And once again, apologies for that.
All right. And just very quickly, was one of our producers has suggested a Malaysian equivalent to this Swiss cheese model. Their suggestion is the roti jala effect.
I disagree. Roti jala can't stand.
It's horrorous, isn't it? I think everything would just go through.
When you roll it up, the multitude of holes in the roti jala is kind of negated a little.
More foolproof.
I philosophically disagree with this.
Nevertheless, let us know what you think about this. You can WhatsApp us at 018-789-8899, or you can tweet us at BFM Radio. We have some messages coming up, and then we're taking a look at the subject of minimum wages, so stay tuned. BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, that was When You Go, That's When You'll Know by The Altons. And you're listening to The Morning Run with Lynn, Roshan and Noel. So now we're on to the subject of minimum wages, which we do discuss every once in a while here on The Morning Run. Not normally, so quite so early as 6 o'clock, but it is an interesting article that we've got in front of us this morning from The Conversation, which is, if I'm not mistaken, an Australian website. So this is obviously from an Australian context. And it's looking at the fact that last year, the minimum wage increase that was put forward was actually one of the smallest in 12 years. It was also delayed for several months for a lot of workers due to the COVID-19 pandemic. And it was about half of what was originally argued for by the Australian Council of Trade Unions. So the trade unions were arguing for a 3.5% increase. But ultimately, this article argues that the idea or the slow pace of increases for minimum wages is really based off of what they call an anachronistic belief that lifting the minimum wage will undermine job creation and competitiveness. So what do you guys think about this? Because, you know, stagnating minimum wages is something we also face here in Malaysia.
Yeah, that's true. So I think some of the advantages of, you know, raising minimum wages is that, you know, you allow people to have a higher quality of life. Maybe they can afford to eat better, they have a little more for their children's education and to bring up their children in a healthy environment. So, and the economic benefits are more spread out when you kind of increase the minimum wage at that certain income bracket. So it does make sense, right, from a whole economic point of view. Of course, some downside, and there's always this argument that we make for emerging markets, right, like Malaysia, we may become less competitive because our costs of salaries have gone up, and especially when we are so reliant on foreign direct investments, it seems like our proposition is about offering cheap labour. So we may lose that competitive advantage. But, you know, I think Malaysia is at this point where we are like not developing, neither are we developed. We need to think more strategically, and we need to kind of think how to move up that value chain, right? And that has been the conversation for the last 20 odd years.
Yeah, I mean, I always find that this conversation around the minimum wage it's become a crutch for the business community, right? And I'm not saying that it isn't going to be a burden on them in all of that jazz. But the fact is, if you don't pay your employees a certain amount of money that they can go and spend in the market, you're then reducing your ability to create a market, which means that you in your long term, you're shrinking your market size, right? Essentially, if you pay workers more, they can spend money on other things. And it's much better than giving rich people more money because they're going to buy Lamborghinis and more expensive things. For an economy to really work, you need the SMEs to thrive. You need the shops on the street people to be spending money there, things like that. People to be buying food, people to be spending on basic services. And you need it to be widespread. It's not a coincidence that minimum wage has stagnated. And this is, of course, a correlation. I'm not saying it's a causation, but wealth inequality has increased even more, more than ever, actually. And if you take a look at the Chinese model, right? Yes, they started off as a place of low cost manufacturing and labor. They're no longer the lowest cost place. In fact, that's Vietnam, which has now taken that. But they created a base of skilled workers, right? And it essentially became more expensive as their value increased. If you want to fight for the cheapest place, that's a fight to the bottom in the long run.
Right. So, you know, yesterday on the Breakfast Grill, I spoke to DPI. They make aerosol and spray paint products. And what happened is we were doing a cost comparison, and he says, why Malaysia is still competitive? Because our cost of labour is cheaper than China. China's wages have gone up significantly. And so Malaysia is still competitive in that sense. But get this, what he is paying a Malaysian worker, now in Vietnam, they could be getting more. which is, we are talking about the general worker level. We're not talking about, you know, maybe the higher end professionals. So what they're finding, there's a lot of wage inflation that's also happening in Vietnam. And it's very interesting. So Malaysia is obviously, you know, has a strong case to increase our minimum wage. It's a bit strange, right, to find that we find ourselves, you know, getting paid as much as a Vietnamese at a general worker level.
Yeah, and also this whole argument around, I mean, it's also about the government setting a precedent, right? It's like, okay, this is the minimum wage. This is what we perceive to be the basic standard of living for a Malaysian in this country. How we get there is going to be another way, but this is where we're going to go. Now, if you pay your workers more, maybe you expect more productivity, and maybe that needs to be needs to happen. But also, again, this is a great way of putting more money into the economy. And I'm not saying it's a perfect solution. I'm just saying it's an overcorrection from the over-prioritization that corporations have gotten over the last 20, 30 years.
The question of how to get there, though, right, is an interesting one to me. Because what we, the situation that we have here in Malaysia is that we can go a couple of years without seeing a rise in the minimum wage. In fact, we last saw a minimum wage hike in, I think it was 2020, and there was a lot of noise around the fact that that was implemented for the second consecutive year. But in some countries, I think Australia is one of them, correct me if I'm wrong, they raise the minimum wage by a small percentage every year. So after a certain point, corporations come to expect it, right? It's not a matter of whether or not the minimum wage is going to increase, it's the quantum. And you can factor that into your business plans as well going forward.
Yeah, so businesses want certainty, right? So I think the start is, we know our poverty level income is actually should be higher. So that minimum wage can be guided by that number. And then secondly, I think it makes sense to do it incrementally, but you kind of make it known to the companies what that rate might be. And I think with companies, then they can project, they can plan and do all that. But I think ultimately, the government of Malaysia needs to answer this bigger question. How are we going to move out of this middle income trap, right? And it just has to look at it itself, how it is spending its money, how it's allocating its resources. Is it being the most efficient way?
Well, let us know what you think about this. You can WhatsApp us at 01878988899, or you can tweet us your thoughts over on the Twitter account at BFM Radio. We are heading into the 6:30 news bulletin now, though, and to take you there is Eric Clapton with Change the World, BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, that was My Number by The Falls, and you're listening to The Morning Run with Lynn Mark, Roshan Kanesan and Noel Lim. So it is 6:40 in the morning, and usually about this time on a weekday, we take a look at what kind of news we're seeing out of the international stories. And I have the BBC open in front of me, and the story that caught our eye here is that the US, South Africa and the EU will all temporarily stop the rollout of the Johnson & Johnson COVID-19 jabs after reports of rare blood clotting.
Yes, so Johnson & Johnson has issued a statement in response saying that it has shared all adverse event reports with the health authorities, and they say they are aware of certain events that have been presented. At present, they say there is no clear causal relationship that has been established between these rare events and their COVID-19 vaccine. I think some background information here. So some of these symptoms that arise are apparently quite similar to the ones that were spotted for those who took the AstraZeneca jab. And that, I guess, is not surprising, because I think the way both vaccines work, they work in quite similar ways. And perhaps that's why we see some similar side effects. But having said that, I think it's only one in a million people that have been affected. When you compare that to what COVID has done, it kills one in 1,000 people who are infected.
Yeah, and also just keep in mind that correlation and causation are two different things. That's also important to keep in mind. If you take a look at the statistics in terms of what is the incidence of clotting in the general population in any case, right? So that's also something that leads into this kind of contemplation, where we think about how what happens post a vaccine and the possible side effects, etc., etc. A side effect is a causation, whereas something else like a rare blood clotting could be correlation. Now, there's some other news as well, because after 20 years, or potentially after 20 years, on the 20th anniversary, it looks like the American troops are set to leave Afghanistan. And this is according to I see this on the BBC, that President Joe Biden is set to announce this. The new deadline would coincide, as I mentioned, with the 20th anniversary of the terror attacks on the World Trade Center and the Pentagon in the U.S. in 2001. Initially, the previous May 1st was the deadline, but that would be tough to meet. So, yeah, this could be. Is this the year that that U.S. troops finally leave Afghanistan? This has been it's been long in the making. Many presidents have tried. President Trump accelerated certain things, but because of the fragility of the situation in the nation, there's always been concerns that pulling out the troops would then cause another imbalance in the current
ecosystem. It would cause a power vacuum,
yeah.
Right?
Essentially, the U.S. troops give support to the government of the day there.
Yeah, so Biden had previously said that the May 1st deadline would be tough to meet. So now the new deadline is September 11th. So we'll have to wait and see whether or not this materializes. But, you know, the U.S. even domestically, is seeing some unrest, because in Minnesota, about 40 people have been arrested just north of the state's capital, Minneapolis, in a second night of unrest. And this is over the police shooting of a black man. So Dante Wright, aged 20 years old, was shot and died after an officer mistook her gun for a taser during a traffic stop. And this is against the backdrop of the fact that the George Floyd murder trial is currently still ongoing. So it's certainly a bit of a hotbed over there.
It's very unfortunate that this thing happened. So what has happened is that protesters have pushed against the fence of the Brooklyn Center Police Headquarters, and a decision has been made to push back the crowd. And there were some incidents of looting as well. So what U.S. President Joe Biden had said, peaceful protest is fine and understandable, but I want to make it clear again, there is absolutely no justification, none, for looting. And so I think, obviously, you know, tempers are running high, right? Emotions. People are very emotional about this. And as you mentioned, it's one case after another.
Yeah, speaking of potential tempers, let me just take a quick look at the front page of the international side of the reserve, Malaysian Reserve, because Japan apparently will release more than 1 million tons of treated water from the stricken Fukushima nuclear plant into the ocean. The government said yesterday, triggering a furious regional reaction and fierce opposition from local fishing communities. And one of the people who are upset by this is China, who've slammed the decision and as extremely irresponsible. And South Korea has also summoned the Japan ambassador. This is actually something to keep in mind, considering the regional impacts of this.
So could this be another kind of catalyst for more unrest in the region? So we'll have to wait and see. But right now we're about to head into some messages, and then we'll be taking a look at our own local papers and portals. So be sure to stay tuned. BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, that was Human by The Pretenders, and you're listening to The Morning Run with Lynn, Roshan and Noel. So about this time of the morning now, we are taking a look at what's on the front pages of our local papers and portals. So let's start, why not, with the New Straits Times. Noel, you have that in front of you. What's caught your eye?
Yes, their story of the day. They are covering the Ramadan Bazaar. So taking a look at what happened yesterday, some of the NSD reporters had went to stake out the bazaars, and because it rained, so the bazaars were started on a much restrained note, as heavy rain and thunderstorms kept customers away. And so they also spoke to some vendors there, and apparently business is 50% down compared to 2019. 2019 they had doubled the crowd, and no queues would be forming. And also some vendors had tried their online business, but profits were relatively small.
Actually, speaking of the rain, though, I think yesterday we did hear some reports of really terrible rain and flooding in the centre of the city, like to the extent that I believe cars were floating off the road, things like that. So it was certainly quite the deluge.
Yeah, to be honest, when I see these videos, I wonder, is this like an old video or is it a current video? You can't tell, right? Because these floods can be quite recurring.
Yeah, I've seen it happen near my house.
Okay, then so, you won't know whether it's real or not. And I'm just very quickly, just another piece of news here about vaccines. So the private hospitals are asking for help from the government because for them to procure their own vaccines to inoculate frontliners and others who may need it early. They actually need the government to tell the private companies who sell these vaccines.
Speaking of, on a related note to vaccinations, on the front page of the Malaysian Reserve, it's not the main main headline, it's the one, the second headline, I'm just going to call it that. Malaysia on the brink of a fourth wave infection, and the story reads, doctors warn that Malaysia is on the brink of a fourth wave as the total number of active cases shot to 16,300 yesterday. According to data from the MOH, there were 1,700 new daily cases reported versus 1,290 recoveries, and 12 new deaths were also recorded yesterday. When the daily cases reported are more than the recoveries, that's always a concerning sign, in addition to the fact that the number, basically your net active cases, increase, mm-hmm. right? So this is, again, let's bring up the Swiss cheese model once again. Essentially,
the Roti Jala model.
No, I refuse. There are multiple layers of defense, and some of them may not be foolproof. That's why we've got to have these multiple layers to essentially reduce the probabilities of spreading the virus and things like that. And it is cumbersome and all of that, but it's also... It's part of the, because we don't want to go back to a situation where the incidences of the viruses go back up to what, 5,000 cases. It was that at one point. We don't want it to peak again. It has sort of, on a weekly basis, I think based on the case numbers, it has kind of flattened, but it's starting to ascend a little bit. And that is a concerning sign. And on that related note, it seems that the COVID-19 situation in Sarawak continues to deteriorate as it hit another record high of new daily infections. The health ministry has begun mobilizing personnel in Sarawak to help contain the virus, but the epicenter of the third COVID-19 wave began in Sabah. This was amid the state election last year, and really nothing, it hasn't really settled down since then. So now that focus is on Sarawak, and hopefully they can manage it, because they're more spread out and more vulnerable than the focus that is given to the Klang Valley or even Peninsula overall. In January, Health Ministry Director General Dr. Noh Hisham Abdullah cited outbreaks in rural part of Sarawak as the greatest fear. So that's something to keep in mind, especially as the state battles this.
And speaking of pandemic fears, the Star's front page this morning is, the headline is Dark Web of Pandemic Scams. So this is a story continued on page 3. The public has been warned of fake vaccines, forged vaccine passports, and because police have become aware of syndicates peddling fake vaccines on the dark web to those who are desperate, of course, to be vaccinated against the pandemic. And I do think there is a special place in whatever, a special place in hell for people who prey on these kinds of life and death fears in order to make money. So it's worth it to definitely be aware of these kinds of things. As of right now, private healthcare is not yet opening vaccines. So basically, our source of information should be the government here. There's also an interesting story on page 2 talking about the MRT3 tender, which is set to be open as soon as August, once the cabinet clears the details of the urban public transport project, which should hopefully bridge the gaps between the current, what we currently see in our public transport system.
Well, you know, for people who are really keen to perform their Hajj, maybe not this year, but next year, the Saudi Arabian Airlines, Saudia, they will be cooperating with the IATA for the trial of the IATA travel pass. And we may see the first trial between KL and the Jeddah route on April 19.
Some interesting news here on the business front. It seems that India-based Pine Labs has acquired Fave, Southeast Asia's consumer financial technology platform. It's a deal valued at about 185 million ringgit. This was, I think it came out yesterday. It was quite interesting. I think Joel Neo, who's the CEO and co-founder, was talking about it on Clubhouse along with other investors. The acquisition will help both companies apparently accelerate their growth in Asia and unlock massive consumer opportunities across retail, food and beverages, fashion, and as well as fast-moving consumer good markets. Fave, I think, has about 6 million consumers, or has enabled 6 million consumers in the region, save what they report to be $400 million across 40,000 retailers since 2016. It currently operates in 35 cities across Malaysia, Singapore, and Indonesia. And with that, Fave will be launching in India this year. So this acquisition is interesting. I wonder what kind of synergies they'll have in this space, because Faith is not really that top tier e-wallet when you think about it, right? They're like a Groupon, a modern version of Groupon, where you get vouchers and discounts and things like that.
Well, Malaysian entrepreneurs are spreading their wings.
Yeah, that's good. That's good news to hear, I think.
And the last story out of the Star for us this morning would be on page 6, tackle overcrowding issues. So this is a call from parents asking for more organized dismissals at schools, or when schools, you know, when school's out and you see this rush of children out the doors and into their buses or into their parents' cars. It can be incredibly crowded. In a lot of cases, it's hard to maintain social distancing as well within the school corridors and confines. And we have also had some reports of COVID-19 cases cropping up in schools, and that's what we're going to be discussing later on at about 7:15 with Dr. Helmi Haja Maidin, who's an internal medicine specialist at Pantai Hospital KL. So be sure to stay tuned for that. But right now, we're about to head into the 7 o'clock news bulletin, and to take you there is CCR with Cotton Fields. Stay tuned, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.